On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a wild world out there, a little too wild lately, and 6 years into a Bush administration that promised security, humility, and effectiveness, a lot of Americans are asking what's going on. Asia going nuclear with a North Korean A-bomb, the heart of the Mideast apparently going nuclear with Iran unchecked, Iraq still in meltdown above the world's most vital energy supplies. These problems didn't start in 2000, but they sure didn't end then. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has suggested it's just a matter of turbulence on the way to victory. Others see a crisis of crises. Up next, On Point, turbulence or engine failure with Condoleezza Rice and Bush foreign policy. Joining me first today from Princeton, New Jersey, is Brett Stevens. He's a member of the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal. He recently met with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice at the offices of the Journal. Brett Stevens, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
I should say right at the outset, there are a lot of ways to look at the direction of U.S. foreign policy, but I have stolen your big framing, your questions that you took away from your meeting with Condoleezza Rice here pretty directly, turbulence or loss of altitude or engine failure in Bush foreign policy. What was it about your conversation with Condoleezza Rice? And granted, this is before the North Korean claimed nuclear test that left you uneasy, Mr. Stevens.
Well, interviewing Secretary Rice, she tends to take the long view, and one might say the too long view, in that she sees her tenure as Secretary of State as somewhat analogous to the Jimmy Burns or the Secretaries of State who Dean Acheson, who were present at the creation, as they say, at the beginning of the Cold War. She thinks that we're in this for the very long haul, and argues that what she's doing is sort of establishing the framework and the institution, the frameworks and the institutions to see us through it. That means that she tends to interpret, in her words, the events of the present day that you alluded to in your intro, what's happening in Baghdad, what's happening in Cairo, what's happening in Damascus, and now, of course, in Pyongyang, is just so much turbulence. I take it it's an airplane analogy, but there's also a question which I tried to pose in the write-up of my interview with her. Whether something more profound and more disturbing isn't in fact going on, which is that we're suffering, the reversals we're seeing are more serious, the consequences are graver, and the risks to the institutions she's trying to establish might be considerably greater.
You say that she seems to, or does, describe the tensions, the conflicts going on right now as kind of long twilight struggle. Of that kind, when you say Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran and Osama bin Laden of some fame, and we might add this week Kim Il-jung in North Korea, seem to believe it's apocalypse nigh. So too cool, too detached?
Well, there is a question whether this Cold War is the right analogy for the struggle, whatever you want to call it, war on terror or the long war or whatever it is we call it. There is a question whether the Cold War is the right analogy. To a large extent, in hindsight, we now look at the Soviet Union as a kind of status quo power that was interested in advancing its interests, retaining its possessions, and being a part, however truculently, of a global world order. When you look at countries like Iran or countries like North Korea, they are what you might call revisionist regimes. They want to overthrow the existing world order for one reason or another, and they might be operating from premises and assumptions which are radically different from our own. I mean, if you are Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and you think seriously, and it's a question whether he does think this seriously, but if he does, that the coming of the so-called 12th Shiite Imam is at hand, then his calculations about the uses of a nuclear weapon might be different from what you might expect of just another country like France or Britain, or India or Pakistan trying to acquire a nuclear weapon. And so that, and the same goes with Kim Jong-il in North Korea. What uses does he want to put his apparent nuclear capability? Does he want to, is it defensive, or does he want to radically reshuffle the decks, the deck in Northeast Asia? Mm. I think there's a risk of thinking that, that what's happening here is just a replay of the Cold War.
You've sat with her very recently and come away saying that implicit in much of what Condoleezza Rice says is the idea that the United States has the luxury of time. She almost takes the position of standing somewhere in the future and looking back on this period as this period of turbulence. What's the perspective that leads her to believe that, you know, we'll ride this out and win instead of some other conclusion?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that was to a certain extent an interpolation, but I think it's clear an interpolation on my part. But it's clear, for instance, from her diplomacy in Iran. I mean, there is a very real question that confronts people in our intelligence, European intelligence agencies, as to just when Iran might pass the so-called point of no return in terms of its ability to acquire, develop, and deploy a nuclear bomb. I mean, we've seen national intelligence estimates say it's 10 years away. Mm. The Israelis are speaking of 18 months, and the Israelis were telling me that 6 months ago. So maybe it's a year from now. But the diplomacy that Condi Rice is employing through the United Nations is necessarily slow. It's incremental, and it's certainly not going to reach. It's certainly not going to achieve the level of diplomatic or economic pressure that is likely to persuade the leaders in Tehran that their interests are probably not best served by having a nuclear bomb. So, you know, you get the sense on that front alone that she's thinking, well, maybe, you know, we have years to deal with the Iranians, when in fact the issue might be a matter of months.
We'll look at what you might suggest there, but what about Condoleezza Rice herself? I mean, she famously kind of flash when she first came in, famously close to the Bush family, lots of images of her looking very stylish around the world, a very articulate figure by any measure, and yet you describe a kind of emotional detachment. She says, no, she's not running for president. And more than that, she'll be glad when she gets to return to Stanford or do something else. Does she still seem into the job?
Oh, I think she's into the job, but I think that she sees, I mean, my guess is that she sees herself more as a George Kennan type than an Eisenhower type or someone who ultimately looks at the world through academic lenses and who is sort of, I mean, this was my impression, but, you know, is energized intellectually, but it's not clear whether she's also energized emotionally about some of these issues. And I'll give you an example. I was in Egypt 3 months ago talking with dissident figures, some of whom have been imprisoned or very, very brutally treated by the Mubarak regime.
And this is Egypt, where Condoleezza Rice has kind of laid down the line and said, you've got to democratize.
Well, she said that a year ago or a little more than a year ago. She went to Cairo and she gave this remarkable sort of typically neoconservative speech saying, you know, it's time to, you know, it's time for the Mubarak regime to change. It's time to end the authoritarianism. It's time to allow, you know, a thousand flowers to bloom in civil society. And a lot of people in Egypt took that message seriously and felt that the Bush administration had their back, so to speak. Well, it's a year later, and some of these people are in jail, and the Bush administration is really nowhere to be seen when it comes to supporting the pro-democracy, pro-moderation, pro-pluralism, pro-liberalism forces in Egypt. And I think that's been a kind of remarkable turnaround on the part of the administration and on the part of Dr. Rice.
Brett Stevens, let me ask you, because a lot of people may read your takeaway here. She says turbulence, but you're concerned there may be a loss of altitude in U.S. Leadership, I guess, or even critical engine failure in foreign policy. But where you would have the country turn from that observation might be very different from others. You've been strong kind of conservative supporters here. If you were to restart those engines, what policy steps would you propose, you know, in a nutshell?
Well, I think the U.S., first of all, has to energize its the quality of its public diplomacy in terms of advocating, you know, the issues that Bush laid out in his or the principles that Bush laid out in his second inaugural support for freedom, for genuine moderates, genuine opposition to autocrats who pose as allies of the United States, people like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, people like Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan. That's something that has to happen. I think the Iranian issue is a much more worrying one than Rice and her deputies at the State Department seem to be treating it.
We're joined right now from Washington by Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for the Washington Post. She traveled with Secretary Rice on Condoleezza Rice's very recent tour of the Middle East. Robin Wright, thank you so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
So we'll look at the big picture, but first, just in the Middle East, your headline, Rice's tour yields little progress on key issues. What kind of reception did she get last week?
Well, I think she got a warm reception, but the fact is most people that I talked to, senior Arab officials on every stop, felt that she was did not bring any new initiatives and that the trip was largely unproductive. It was variously described as a cheerleading trip, an attempt to tell them what things they needed to do, and often an inability to listen to what they needed, what help they needed specifically to get those things done.
You report that everywhere she went, people asked her to revive U.S. leadership, to break deadlocks in that region, but that on Iraq, on Arab-Israeli peace, on democracy promotion, on fostering a moderate bloc of Arab states, not a lot pushing forward. Is the problem Condoleezza Rice? Is the problem something more fundamental to U.S. policy? What's she running up against, Robin?
Oh, I think it plays out on a lot of different levels. The basic one is U.S. foreign policy seems to be drifting a little bit with all the problems in Iraq. The trip was actually quite sobering. We had to overfly Baghdad for almost an hour because there'd been a mortar attack at the U.S.-run airport in Baghdad.
Too dangerous to land.
Too dangerous to land. And, of course, we took Black Hawk helicopters just from the airport to the green zone. Mm. And we had to wear flak jackets and helmets. As we were standing outside, there was a constant series of flights by helicopter medevac taking wounded soldiers to the hospital. You have the feeling that increasingly the United States is losing an ability to bring this to some kind of conclusion anytime in the near future, whether it's the death toll, the escalating brutality and civil strife, Iraqis against each other, sectarian violence, Sunni versus Shiite. The death toll is just staggering. It's Iraqi troops have been killed at a rate of twice American troops, and then there are all the civilians whose bodies are being dumped all over Baghdad and other parts of Iraq every day.
And that's just one theater of challenges here. Robin, you cover really the world through the prism of Condoleezza Rice's work. Brett Stevens at the Wall Street Journal was talking with us earlier about what he sensed as an emotional detachment on her part, a sense that this is turbulence, we'll ride it out, but everything's going to be fine. How do you read her level of engagement, and what leads to that kind of, you know, cool when things look so hot?
Well, I think she's engaged. I think the problem is that the U.S. can't make some critical decisions to try to make up for the mistakes it's made, particularly in Iraq, which has left us with a sense of vulnerability. It's like the post-Vietnam period, or the tail end of the Vietnam period, when we appeared to be a paper tiger. We couldn't win that war against, you know, small third world country, and that has limited our ability, whether it's to deal with Iran, North Korea, we're even having problems with the tragic genocide in Darfur. We can't rally forces. There are allies who are reluctant to join us. We are not seen as capable of carrying out the kind of winning the confrontations that we have launched. Afghanistan, 5 years later, looks like a terrible mess with the comeback of the Taliban. And that creates an image that makes it very difficult, no matter how engaged one is, to pull off significant successes.
And now, this week, we have North Korea with its claimed nuclear test. At some point, do we have a crisis of crises, Robin? I mean, forest fires all over the place. Is there a kind of collective crisis that emerges here, or do you see these as all distinct, you know, things in their own slots?
Well, it's a bit of both. Each one has been building on its own for several years, but they do, again, create that aura, you put it well, the crisis of crises. And it makes it all the more difficult because, it's difficult to launch a series of UN resolutions all at the same time against Iran and North Korea. It's difficult to rally countries to send troops to Darfur and Lebanon, as well as keep them in Iraq. You know, whether it's the resources of other countries, the focus of other countries, and our leverage in asking for so many favors or so much cooperation. And plus, as a nation, we tend to be able to take only one issue on at a time, and that makes it difficult when we're confronted with so many.
And we've got a lot more than one right now. You quote a senior Egyptian official calling U.S. policy, and I mean, we'll look at the source, but still saying, calling it increasingly unrealistic. Robin Wright, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let me turn, if I may, to Anne in Rocky Hill, Connecticut. Hi, Anne, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I have two points I would like to make. Number one, our going into Iraq seems to have created chaos in the Middle East, and it has given Iran a new stepping stool to be like a power broker,
mm-hmm.
because the two, Iran and Iraq, were enemies. Saddam was a Sunni,
mm-hmm.
and Iran, we know, is Shia, and they were enemies for years, and now Iran is grateful that Saddam is gone, et cetera.
So what would you like to see, Anne? We're in there. Everybody can see that. What do we do?
Right, right. Well, first of all, my second point, Tom, is I think we should be talking directly to our enemies. James Baker did it when he was Secretary of State. We should be talking to Iran. We should be talking to Syria. When the conflict was going on with Israel and Hezbollah, wouldn't it have been an idea to sit down with Syria? I think they would have brokered with us.
And let us pick that up, the idea of going straight into conversations there. Robin, I want to hear you on that, but let's first hear from Condoleezza Rice, because this came up also last night. She was talking with a Wolf Blitzer on CNN. He asked about former Secretary of State James Baker, of course, in the first Bush administration, who has said that bilateral talks with North Korea have to be hard-nosed and determined, but that it is, quote, not appeasement to talk to your enemies. Here's what Secretary Rice had to say in response.
Wolf, has anybody noticed that we've actually talked to the North Koreans?
But they want to do it separately, not within the framework of this multi-party negotiation.
Let's ask the question, why do they want to do it separately and not within the framework?
They want respect, they say.
They get respect when they come to the six-party talks, and Chris Hill has had dinner with the North Korean negotiator.
But if it potentially could turn things around and end this nuclear North Korea, what's wrong with a direct dialogue like that?
Let me just remind you, we tried direct dialogue. The United States tried direct dialogue with the North Koreans in the 90s, and that resulted in the North Koreans signing on to agreements that they didn't keep. And the United States didn't have the force of others like China and South Korea to say to the North Koreans, that is an agreement that you should have kept.
Robin Wright, here's a picture. Former Bush 1 Secretary of State Jim Baker saying, we could talk to them, talk tough, but talk. Condoleezza Rice saying, hey, we've tried that, and that's enough, thank you. What's going on here? Is it blinkered? Is it rigidity? Or do they know something Jim Baker doesn't?
Well, you put your finger, as your caller did, on the fundamental debate that's going on in Washington today, and that is, do you talk to your enemies or not? Or do you confront them or contain them to try to force them to change their policies? And then that plays out with Iran, North Korea, played out with Iraq in the run-up to the war, played out with Afghanistan. But the fact is, the Bush administration has not been consistent. It's also gotten us into a position that if we do talk with the North Koreans or the Iranians, we do so out of weakness, not out of strength. And that has tainted the argument a little bit as well. But it is the argument is gaining increasing momentum to engage with, whether it's with the Iranians or the Syrians or the North Koreans, at some level, to say, if you comply with certain steps, we will engage. So there's the Bush administration is playing it both ways, as in the case of North Korea.
Robin, let me get one more call here with you, if I may, from Fairfax, Virginia. Mahmoud is on the air. Hi, Mahmoud. You're with us. Hi.
Hello, Tom. I wanted to say, first of all, that it's obvious to everybody that this is a prelude to what's going to happen in Iran. The other thing is
that North Korea is a warm-up?
Now the world can only talk in the strongest possible terms about North Korea. That's where we're left, what's left with us. And then also democratizing regimes that are going to fall in the hands of Iran because they've been brutalized by secular governments only further strengthens Iran. You know, Iran is the only country that has been brutalized and whose revolution has been hijacked by theologians. They are the only country that are going to become the kind of democracy we want. Iran is the only country that's the key to success. And going to Iran from a position of weakness and defeat, I mean, it was kind of funny, actually. I saw the vice president was saying that we brought the entire Iraqi government from Iran because that was the only, you know... And,
so what are you saying? Be hard-nosed with Iran? Be tougher? Or talk to them?
We need to be... We have fallen into every trap that the Iranians have set for us. I wish when they show pictures of Iran, they would translate the words. On their bombs, on their missiles, it says, "We shall crush America under our feet." And let me just say what their goal is. Their goal is to throw us out of the region. And if it was not for one issue, and that's Israel, we would leave.
Mahmoud, we've got your perspective. Robin Wright, a final thought from you. There's Iraq with all the trouble that you flew right into. There's Iran next door. Do you see it at this point as more likely, after North Korea's announcement that Iran ends up nuclear, do we end up with nuclear weapons races in Asia, in the Middle East, with the crisis?
I think there is not yet an interest by most of the countries that feel threatened by the proliferation in Iran and North Korea at this stage to engage in an arms race. I think people still want to avoid it, and I think it still can be avoided. But it will require some very talented and dedicated diplomacy at this stage. And it's going to be very hard to see how this administration can do all of that at the same time.
Do you see Condi Rice as leading Bush foreign policy or fighting it or somewhere in the middle?
No, I think she's the most powerful Secretary of State we've had in decades, even arguably more than Henry Kissinger, because of the influence she has on the president. During the Nixon administration, the president was very engaged, very knowledgeable about foreign policy, and he and Kissinger brokered it together. In this administration, Condi Rice has enormous influence in shaping foreign policy and educating the president and in guiding exactly what we do, far more so than Colin Powell during the first Bush administration.
Most powerful Secretary of State since Henry Kissinger.
And before that.
Robin Wright, right on her tail. Robin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. I'm joined now from Washington by Bruce Gentleson. He's professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, served from 2000 to 2005 as director of the Terry Sanford Institute of Public Policy. He was special assistant to the director of the State Department Policy Planning Staff during the Clinton administration. Bruce Gentleson, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So give us your big step back. What's going on? Is this of a piece? Is there some texture that runs through all these problems, or are these individual baubles of the ball here? What's happening?
Well, each one has its own dynamic and timeline. But in many respects, they really all come out of the ways in which the Bush administration's overall approach to foreign policy is kind of coming crashing down. You know, their sense was they could use American power to reorder the world. And they genuinely, I think, believed they were doing that, you know, in ways that would also spread democracy. But the fundamental flaws and contradictions in that whole effort are clearly seen in Iran. And they're also being seen in the ways in which they use the axis of evil to further complicate really difficult relationships and issues with countries like Iran and North Korea.
Now, why does that further complicate relationships? President Bush presumably put it forward as a clarifying idea.
Right. And it had some appeal to some people at the time because it seemed very simple. But like a lot of simple ideas, it proved to be simplistic. And I think its effects were twofold. One is the country in this so-called axis that we started with, Iraq, was actually the most contained. There were terrible things going on there. There had been the gassing of the Kurds going back to the late 1980s. that, in fact, the Reagan administration did nothing about. But there was a sense, I think, of this wasn't the most pressing issue. And then the effects of this, in your earlier segment, I heard the statement from Secretary of State Rice saying that there's no relationship
between Iraq and American troubles elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it is so obvious that it is. We're overextended in Iraq. Iraq has called into question two fundamental things about American leadership. One is our legitimacy, the sense that people believe that we have a right to do what we want to do. And the way we went to war in Iraq fundamentally questioned that. But arguably, even more important is our effectiveness, because people then say, look what you've done in Iraq. You've made the terrorism problem worse. You've complicated the Middle East. And you've distracted attention from a whole host of other issues. And so when you have both your legitimacy and your effectiveness question, you're in big trouble.
Right now, Tom is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. I've got to disagree with your first guest, last assertion, and your present guest.
Okay, what do you see?
When Bill Clinton left office, the North Korean fuel rods were sealed and locked up. Northern Iraq and somewhat southern Iraq was at peace. We were beginning to make overtures to Iran. And, of course, he ended up with his attempts for peace in Palestine.
Of course, it turns out the North Koreans had another secret line of development going on. But, okay, so what does that leave you thinking, Tom?
That anything that Bill Clinton touched is any fingerprints are thrown out. Ignore it all. So why, with the hypocrisy now, does Bush think that his failed policies are somehow going to be followed by the future administration?
You're thinking he's got two more years of this at most, and then it'll be gone on the other side. Tom, thanks for your call. Bruce Gendelson, how about it? You were a senior foreign policy advisor to Vice President Al Gore and the Gore-Lieberman presidential campaign. Were we on a better beam 6 years ago? We've got a lot of fundamental problems at work here. A lot of them were not new under George Bush. Were we on a better path? Could this have been a very different 6 years?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, there are some problems out there that would have been there because the world's been changing. China's been going stronger and the like. But so many of the problems are attributable to the way the Bush administration has gone about trying to use American power. And your caller's example is a good one. There are a couple of issue areas, and Korea was one, where the Bush administration didn't have a better policy. They just threw the Clinton one out because it was like they wanted to do the un-COLA. And there was an incident in March in 2001. Secretary of State Powell was greeting the South Korean president and saying, we're going to kind of keep working with this policy. It has some flaws, but we're going to correct them. And then the next day, he was totally undercut at the White House by Vice President Cheney and President Bush, who said, no, even though it does have some elements that are working, we just don't want to do it because it was theirs.
But Ken Mellman, the head of the Republican National Committee, has been making fun, I guess would be the lightest way of putting it, of those Clinton policies, saying, you know, Madeleine Albright took a basketball autographed by Michael Jordan to North Korea. Basketball diplomacy was never going to cut it, he says.
You know, the political people can have their coy one-liners and stuff. If you look at the polls, the American people are no longer buying it. The president is at an incredibly low rating, and even on the issues that he considered his bread and butter. The American people are concerned because the threats we face, if you ask the question, are you more secure than you were 6 years ago, I think most people in this country, most people, not just Democrats, would say no, and that's of great concern. These policies are failing.
Bruce Gendelson, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Dan Blumenthal. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, worked in the Secretary of Defense's office on international security affairs from 2002 to 2004. Dan Blumenthal, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Give us your perspective here. We've heard a couple of angles in this hour from Brett Stevens at the conservative Wall Street Journal editorial page, saying Condi Rice describes it as turbulence, but we may have engine failure here. That Bruce Gendelson says, more or less, yes, indeed, and it's because Bush walked away on a more dangerous course that had been set out before. How do you see what's going on with all these fires around the world?
Well, I think that Brett Stevens is correct when he says that we're experiencing engine failure. I would say on the North Korea issue, to turn around and say that that this is the result of the Bush administration's policies, I think is overlooking 20 years of history with North Korea. You know, I think that we've tried in many different ways, and the South Koreans and others have tried in many different ways to cajole, to convince, to use diplomacy. to get the North Koreans to abandon their weapons quest. The South Koreans and the North Koreans signed an agreement in the early 90s, and we pulled off our own tactical nuclear weapons from South Korea. We caught them cheating on agreements, and the Clinton administration essentially bought them off to freeze one of their programs. And
the other one went on secretly. And we've heard this back and forth since the test. But let me ask you. I mean, here we are. The test has happened. And yet we've got people saying, are we sleepwalking through these things? As these crises mount, is there a point at which it becomes a general crisis? Are we there?
We are there. I think we're definitely there. I think the world is a different place after the test by the North Koreans. I think that we are actually closer to a nuclear event than we were beforehand. I think that North Koreans obviously proliferate, sell anything to anybody. But the problem lies with North Korea. You know, that's first and foremost. The United States over the last few decades, as well as its allies, have failed to confront North Korea, have failed to make North Korea pay a single price for its defiance of the world. But this is a regime that has proved one thing over the last 20 years, and that is that it will stop it at nothing to get nuclear weapons.
So we're looking at that. We're also looking at what's been proven over the last 6 years by the Bush administration. Let me turn to David, calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you today?
We're good. What do you see, David?
Well, I think we can't forget that Condoleezza Rice was originally a mentee, a student of Brent Scowcroft.
Yeah.
And who
this is President Bush I's national security advisor.
Right, who mm-hmm. personified the cool, calculating foreign policy judgment of his generation.
Right, the realist school there.
Right. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to claw back to that kind of normal foreign policy, but she's still beholden to Dick Cheney and the neoconservative wackos, for lack of a better word, who've been running foreign policy for the last 6 years.
I take it you think we'd be better off if she did claw back to the Scowcroft school.
Yeah, except I don't know that we have enough time, and I don't know if she has enough running room, because we're really going to have to pile up some more failures, in order to give her that room, and then she's going to be too tainted with those failures to actually pull off the act.
Yeah, and the clock's ticking. David, let us pick that up, and Dan Blumenthal, I'll come to you first. I mean, putting aside the Clinton-Gore school for a moment, David looks at Scowcroft and Cheney and sees Condoleezza Rice as kind of caught in the middle. Do you see it that way, and which way do you wish she'd pull?
Well, first of all, the so-called realist school is anything but realistic. I mean, remember Brent Scowcroft brought us the early end to the Iraq War, which writers such as Tom Ricks...
You're talking about the Persian Gulf War.
Persian Gulf War. Yeah. Which writers such as Tom Ricks mm-hmm. in his book Fiasco has said essentially was, because we ended it when we did, was a strategic failure, that we would have had to face Saddam one way or another because we left his military so intact. So,
well, okay, but then he describes another failure, which we're sitting on right now. So
sure,
are you saying go with the neocon impulse? Do you wish you'd be stronger
well,
that
way? I don't know what the neoconservative impulse is. I don't think there's a single neoconservative in the administration right now, I think.
What about just Bush doctrine then? Preemption, unilateralism, strength beyond challenge.
I think one thing that is very clear, in remembering that it's a post 9/11 world, is that now next time we see North Korean missiles on a launching pad, and remember it was Secretary of Defense William Perry, a Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, who called last time in July for preemptive strikes against missiles against North Korean missiles. I think this time, and people thought it was a pretty crazy thing to call for. I think this time, when we see missiles, North Korean missiles on a launching pad, and we're not sure whether they're nuclear tipped or not, that idea doesn't seem so crazy anymore. So preemption has always been in the American arsenal for hundreds of years, and I think it's now going to be brought more to the fore because of the failure of diplomacy.
Maybe never more so than with George W. Bush. Bruce Gentleson, how do you see this tension, or do you, between a kind of Scowcroft approach for Republican Secretary of State and a Dick Cheney approach? Do you see Condoleezza Rice sort of stretched between those two poles?
Yeah, very much so. I think if I could point to one thing for listeners to watch, in the North Korea case and in the Iran case. And it's true that Secretary Rice changed the Iran policy a bit last spring. But that one thing is this question of regime change. In both of these cases, one of the elements, and believe me, we're dealing with regimes here that may well not listen to just about anything. But the nature of foreign policy is you've got to put out the best possible strategy you can to try to get the change. And one of the crucial messages is that we're interested in policy change, not regime change. You know, the irony is that one of the main successes that the Bush administration had in its first term was Libya. Libya did basically the full Monty on its WMD, gave it all up.
Gave up its nuclear
ambition.
Got
out of the business of terrorism. Why did it do it? It did it because there actually was, you know, a serious diplomatic strategy that started with secret talks in the Clinton years that the British were part of, and in which dealing with Gaddafi, the rogue, the original rogue of all rogues, we made the point that if you do policy change, we won't do regime change. And so far on Iran and North Korea, that only that has to come from us. You know, the Russians and Chinese, North Koreans aren't interested in that, the Europeans, you're right. And that's what, you know, the difference is. I think that this administration still is trying to do blame avoidance on these problems. Say, look, we tried diplomacy, it didn't work. They're not really yet committed to problem solving. And that may well be because even with Secretary Rice's relationship with the president, there may be limits she's running up to in terms of what I would see still as this dominant kind of neoconservative change the world view that keeps backfiring.
And Bruce, let me ask you, and I'll ask Dan as well, but running through this, how do you see Iraq playing? Whatever the strategic impulse here, is the United States too strapped, too weakened by the expense of blood and manpower in Iraq to be taken seriously on other issues? Can we walk and chew this big wad of gum at the same time?
You know, the Bush administration went into Iraq in many respects. It was never only about Iraq. It was about this demonstration of American power. And the one thing it was right about was it had a demonstration effect, but the opposite. It's left our leadership in global leadership in tatters. It's fractured the domestic consensus that came out of 9/11. And here, too, I would take the one thing that Secretary Rumsfeld, in a memo he wrote in October 2003, said, every day I need to wake up and ask myself, are we killing, capturing, deterring more terrorists than are being created? And if you take that, in effect, two-column accounting, and you even give the administration some credit it deserves, the net effect is negative. And I think that even in its most fundamental issue, failures in the war on terrorism far outweigh its successes. And a lot of that, as was stated in the recent intelligence study, is due to Iraq.
Dan Blumenthal, how about it? Can the U.S. steady the global scene and climb back into respected leadership with Iraq around its neck?
Well, Iraq is obviously the problem that has to be solved and has to be fixed. In large measure, you know, the fact of the matter is that when there were other demonstration effects, the way we first got the North Koreans to actually come to the table in 2003 was the fact that we had taken forceful action against Iraq.
But here we are today. They've exploded a nuclear test,
right,
we're told.
Right. Now, the handling of Iraq since then has, of course, been poor by any measure. You know, the Clinton administration's policy on Iraq was regime change. If you recall, they signed into law a piece of legislation that called for regime change. And I think the central point is that there are certain countries, certain regimes, whether it's Iraq or North Korea, that simply won't give up their quest for WMD.
But is Iraq drowning American foreign policy imperatives right now?
I think that Iraq is definitely causing us to, I would say, not apply the tougher measures we need to apply in the case of North Korea and Iran. Yes, the answer to your question is it is drowning a lot of our energy and a lot of our will.
Well, and there's one big Bush legacy. Let me get a call from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Nelson. Hi, Nelson. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say that, no, I don't feel safer now than I did 6 years ago. I'm ex-military, ex-army. Back in 1994, I was in Korea when the first dictator died, and there was that whole hype of what's going to happen, yada, yada, yada.
Kim Jong-il's father, yes?
Yeah, I thought that was the most scariest time of my life, because I was actually right there up at the Cap Casey, right there at Second ID.
Yep, on the DMZ.
Yeah, and I thought that was the scariest time of my life, because I really thought that the North Koreans would come across then. But, you know, it all played out, and since from that, during the entire time of the Clinton administration, other than that one point, I was never scared of North Korea. I always thought that our country had a handle on North Korea.
And today?
Once North Korea shot that missile over Japan towards the west coast of the United States, that's when I started to think, you know, hey, these guys are serious about being able to reach out and touch us. And I don't think that we've done anything to North Korea to deter them from thinking that way.
Nelson, we hear it. You were on the front line, and it looks scarier to you today. Dan Blumenthal, what about it? At some point, you know, polls are coming up in November. Should Americans look around and say, this is too much instability? This is too many crises going in the wrong direction. We need a change? Or do you say, stay the course with this White House and hope for better?
Well, I would say stay the course with this White House is not the way to go. But I, you know, the idea, you look at the North Korea crisis and the ideas that are coming forward from the other parties are essentially just getting into the blame game of what happened under the Bush administration, what happened under the Clinton administration, without saying squarely that the world is a dangerous place. We have these regimes that you know, for decades have been pursuing WMD with all kinds of, in the face of all kinds of policies that we've tried. The caller points to the missile tests. I believe, you know, the first missile test that occurred was in 1998 with missiles fired over Japan. The reaction on our part was weak. Again, you know,
there's a history here, and we hear that. We just got a few seconds left. Bruce Gentleson, how about it? Does Congress make a difference if it changes parties? Is this an issue that's going to be at the heart of the presidential campaign? When does the wheel really get turned, or does it?
Congress makes a difference, but ultimately foreign policy is made by the president. And it's pretty staggering to me to hear these, well, it's Clinton's fault 6 years into an administration. I mean, that's frankly, you know, not accepting Harry Truman's notion of the buck stops here. You know, the dilemma is that the world really does need American leadership. It doesn't work very well without it. But the world has little confidence and trust in this administration. It doesn't have trust because of this administration saying we always know better and we'll go our own way unilaterally when we want to. And it doesn't have confidence because the basic competence question, can you solve problems, has come up consistently negative.
What a planet. It's a lot to look out on. We thank each of you for helping us look out on it today. Bruce Gentleson at Duke, thanks very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
And Dan Blumenthal at the American Enterprise Institute. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.